This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town, your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Georgie Coghlan.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation Hour. Happy Friday. What was your first job? Do you remember it? Are you still using skills from your first job? Today we're talking first jobs, and particularly if you've got young people in your household that are about to embark on their first job. What does a first job do to a young person's development? And do sad movies make you feel better? I mean, we all know about feel-good movies, but like me, do you enjoy a cheeky feel-bad movie? Can't wait to chat to you about that.
This is The Conversation Hour with Georgie Coghlan.
Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living, barely getting by. It's all taking.
Oh, yes, we're back into the grind. It's been a big week. We've had the heat, the bushfires, so we thought let's finish on something a little nostalgic. What was your very first job? How old were you? What was the gig? What skills did you learn? Are you using any of those skills today? I remember a bakery in Warrnambool was my first job. I was in year 10, I think. And I suppose what I learnt was I learnt to love carbs. Haven't lost that skill. And I also learnt maths. Some of the days when people didn't use cards, they just used cash. So I became very good at maths, something that I probably don't use anymore today. But as the new school year rolls around, all the kiddies taking off, a lot of kids, particularly 15, 16, 17-year-olds, are getting their first taste of work. I mean, maybe it's a job at the bakery like me, a cafe, an old school paper run. Do you remember those? So today we're talking about what that first job means for a young person's development. Do parents see positive elements of that? What do we need to look out for if our kids are going for a job? Because if your child is taking on an after school job, what does the law actually say about young people at work? And we'd love to hear from you. Has your child just started a job? What are they doing? Have you seen changes in them? Have you seen them become more autonomous, more responsible? And of course, what was your first job? I think we can all remember our first job. I'm hoping that it was a really positive experience for you. Kerry Brown's going to join us. Kerry, now you are a professor of employment and industry at the School of Business and Law at the Edith Cowan University. Kerry, what was your first job?
My first job was 12, and I worked at the Spider Cafe making hamburgers, Queensland style. They had to have pineapple on them.
Well, I'm a bit controversial because I do love pineapple on my pizzas and pineapple in my burgers. So what's the relevance of the name Spiders, Kerry? Why was it called Spiders?
Spider Cafe was a hangover from when it was a 1950s cafe that had drinks that people don't remember these days, but apparently they were soft drinks with a scoop of ice cream in it and they fizzed up.
Yeah, I totally remember and still love a spider. I love a cheeky spider, Kerry.
The retro spider then.
So, Kerry, do you think that you're still using any of those skills from your first job now?
Yes, definitely. Problem solving and definitely working under pressure.
So what should parents be checking when their child is about to start their very first job?
One of the big things are the number of hours that a person under 15 who's still at school can work. Mm-hmm. And it's usually only about 10 or so hours. Every state is different, but 10 hours per week. And it has to fit outside of school hours. And they can't start too early or work too late. So those late shifts for young workers are not usually allowed.
Kerry, what about any other red flags that we need to be looking out for in terms of the employers and what our kids are going to be exposed to?
These days, an employer must hold a license to employ people under the age of 15. People can start quite early. You can actually start from birth working. But there's gradual requirements as you get older, like about 10 is the earliest you can do deliveries of pamphlets or newspapers.
Gee, that's young, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And these are kids walking the streets.
I'm just going to read out a text from Saskia, who said her first job was as a library assistant. 10 years later, I now manage a small library. I've spent my whole paycheck on clothes and books during high school, but it paid a lot better than fast food, and she's still in the industry. Love that. Thanks, Saskia. And we've got Margot that's called in. Margot, what was... No, Margot's dropped out. Okay, well, hopefully, Margot, you can call back. Kerry, what does a part-time job actually teach young people that school sometimes can't?
I think it's about confidence, being socialised to routines. Actually, when you get your roster, you have to actually get up and get ready and go to your job. But it's also, I see these days, that young people have a lot of responsibility in their part-time jobs.
Mm-hmm. And what positive changes do you hear that parents notice when their child starts working? Our daughter's just started working. We own a pub, and we've just noticed a lot more autonomy with her, responsibility, social confidence. What do you hear from parents?
It's all of those things, as well as being able to work in a team and be able to show their initiative.
Do you think that some first jobs carry a better than others for young people, or is it just about that whole experience in the role?
Some first jobs are amazing, particularly in the entertainment industry, but others around, typically young workers will be in the retail and fast food industries. So, you know, they're not necessarily the glamour jobs, but they do give people a sense of responsibility and their own money. Like you said, like the previous caller said about spending on clothes and entertainment, it's an independence of earning wages.
Let's go to Margot in Eltham. You are back, Margot. What was your first job?
My first job was as a tomato picker when I was almost 12. And I would, when you first start picking, you bend over so you get it, so you start picking like that, and then you get a sore back. So then you squat, and you get your legs can't, like you lose feeling in your legs, and then you go on to your knees and you step on a tomato with your knees. This is the early 70s, and it was. I used to take an hour to fill a case, and I got, if it was Romans, I got 25 cents a case, or if it was Romans, I got 20 cents a case. It taught me, the big lesson for me was, I need to get a good education. I can't stand doing this. And it was always hot too, because it was, you do tomato picking in the summer holidays.
Yes.
It was awful. And I any fruit pickers, I'd really feel so free. And also, you'd reach in to the tomatoes, into the bushes, and you'd get spiders. You'd come out with like spiders on your hands. So
that sounds like a tough job, Margot, a physically tough job, which I love that you've linked that by saying you worked really hard. I mean, you're quite young. You said you were 12, so that's an amazing experience that young to work out, okay, I don't necessarily like this. What do I have to do, and what's another area that I need to work on because I don't want to be doing this for the rest of my life?
So now I'm a teacher.
Which is still a tough gig.
Well, no. I teach in university.
Oh, fantastic, yeah. Margot. Thank you for sharing your story with us. Have a great day. Let's go to John in Corumbra. John, what was your first job?
I grew up on a farm, so my first job was just doing everything that was required on the farm. And it was a chook farm, which is really intensive, so it was just part of life. I used to get a bit annoyed when I'd have to work when all my friends at school were doing good stuff. But it taught me I had to be responsible for things.
And did you get paid, John?
Not really, no. Just a bit of pocket money. I mean, no, I never got really paid.
So what do you think it taught you or that you're still using today?
Well, just to be, because it was a chook farm, it was a breeding farm, then you had to be on tap 24 hours a day, a bit like dairy. You just couldn't go away. If it was a hot day, we'd be squirting the chooks to stop them from dying of heat. So it just taught you that you just don't walk away from stuff, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, now I'm pretty well retired, so it was a long time ago.
Responsibility. I love that, John. Thank you for sharing. Sue in Melbourne, what was your first job, Sue?
I took a job at school and going to Monash. Uni at the Tom Piper canning factory in Port Melbourne, because my auntie promised to buy me a car if I got a job.
That's That's a good deal. That's a great deal, Sue.
I know. She bought me a $300 Vauxhall Victor, which was looked like a green frog. But anyway, the significance of the Tom Piper Canning Factory work was that I was one of the few, you know, white people, really, in the whole factory. Mm-hmm. And it was I joined the Food Preservers Union, and my family's very union strong. So, of course, I joined their union and learned an awful lot about work in those sorts of scenarios on the production line with a lot of new people from overseas. And it was absolutely fabulous. You just learned to get along and learn stuff and, you know, work with people from different backgrounds. It was absolutely brilliant.
I love that, Sue. Thank you for sharing your first job story with us. And let's last of all jump to Glenn, who's on the road. Glenn, what would you like to share?
Good morning, Georgie. And your presenter, I'm sorry, who's their name?
I'm by myself today. It's just me.
Oh, okay, myself. I'm sorry.
We're talking to Kerry Brown, though.
Yeah, Kerry. Hi, Kerry. Look, I had a supermarket job when I was a kid, but the thing I wanted to call was I became a teacher and I've just retired after 27 years. And the number of subject selection interviews I sat in on with parents who had actively discouraged their year 10, 11 child from having a job because they thought it would take away from their academic pursuits. And I would reversibly say, no, it's super important that they gain life skills during that time.
Yes, exactly, Glenn, what we were just talking to Kerry about is that obviously school provides so much for our young people, but there is a huge chunk of life experience that school can't give them, isn't there?
Absolutely, and I was always a bit perplexed at the number of careers advisors and senior school teachers who had actively discouraged students from taking on a job, and I think there's a bit of an attitude that needs to be turned around there.
Yeah, I agree with you as a former teacher, Glenn. Thank you so much for sharing that, Glenn. Back to you, Kerry. Lots and lots of interesting first jobs there. Love listening to that. Do you think that there are particularly good starter jobs for teenagers that you'd be steering teenagers towards?
It's really in the retail and hospitality area mm-hmm. that I would think that teenagers would make a great contribution. Now, there's some where these are low-paid areas, and children under 21 or people under 21 actually don't get the full rate of adult salaries unless they're doing adult jobs. And so they're only going to earn from under 15 to about 36% of the adult rate. So it really is about training and development. So if that's not happening in a job, it might be pocket money. Mm-hmm. But if there's training and development in a job, that's fantastic.
Lastly, Kerry, what should a young person do if something at work doesn't feel right?
There are opportunities for institutional redress through the ombudsman and the various industrial relations agencies of different states. So there's redress there. When I was working as a swimming instructor and I had a problem with the rules and regulations, I was told that I could withdraw my labour, and that's really not a right as such, because anybody who doesn't have the ability to withdraw their labour is probably a slave, and that's it. So there's various remedies that can be put in place, though, through the ombudsman.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Kerry, this morning. Kerry Brown, Professor of Employment and Industry, School of Business and Law at the Edith Cowan University. Have a great day, Kerry.
Thanks, Georgie.
Well, coming up as we return to work, weird question, but how are your teeth?
This is The Conversation Hour with Georgie Coghlan.
Well, the summer holidays have sadly faded into the distance, haven't they? Most of us are back at work, back at school. We're back into the daily grind. And for some of us, that grind is a little too literal. Do you know that one in six of us grind our teeth while we're asleep? And one in four of us do it while we're awake. It's called bruxism. And it might sound harmless, but it can actually lead to some pretty serious health issues if we leave this unchecked. So why do we do it? What can we do to stop doing it? Arosha Veera-Cohn is a senior lecturer and a general dentist from the School of Dentistry at the University of Queensland. She's also a practicing dentist looking in people's mouths all day. Arosha, thank you so much for joining us. Why do we grind our teeth, especially when we're asleep and we don't even realise it?
Very good question, Georgie. I ask my patients this all the time. So some of the reasons can be that are obvious, anxiety and stress, of course. We might overindulge sometimes in extra coffee, perhaps, or alcohol, mm-hmm. or nicotine. And probably some of the things that I'm starting to pick up a bit more with my patients now as we're talking about things like sleep apnea or sleep hygiene and trying to leave their phones and devices out of the bedroom. So many, many reasons.
So it sounds like stress is the main trigger and other causes. How do we best treat it? What's the first step?
You just opened a can of worms, I think. I think it depends on what the cause is. Mm-hmm. So if, for example, you suspect you're not sleeping very well or you wake up like you've run out of breath, perhaps you might suffer from sleep apnea, and that might be good to explore with your GP because they have a series of questions that they ask to screen. So that's one option. And I guess stress is something that you can manage with your psychologist or a therapist, or some people will do yoga or yin or meditation and things like that. The things that we can help with in the clinic, in dental, of course, is we can provide like a night guard to help protect your teeth. But a lot of the things that we can offer to manage don't really treat the cause. And in saying that, I wear one at night, mm-hmm. my splint, and I caught myself clenching my teeth because I was thinking of some paperwork I had to do, and I thought, ooh, I better stop doing that. So
yes,
it's a very common issue.
I'm like you, I'm sort of so unconscious about it, and then every now and then I sort of touch my jaw muscles and think, oh my goodness, it's so tight and mm-hmm. so stressed. We were talking in the office this morning because we were talking about some people wake up with a headache and not realising that they're grinding their teeth during the night.
Yes. If you think about it, so it's like delayed onset muscle soreness. So if you went to the gym and did about 2 hours of exercise, you'd feel very, very sore the next day. And it's a little bit like that. Your jaws have been working and working and working while you're asleep, and you wake up with a sore jaw because they're quite tired. Mm.
And our colleagues were talking this morning that they go to a mouth physio, so someone who actually gives them a specific jaw massage to release the tension. Is that something you're hearing more and more of?
Yes, I do refer my patients to a physio who has specialised in, we call it TMJ, so it's the jaw joint and the muscles, and she's been wonderful because she will work with exercises, helping them release and like muscle tension. Mm-hmm. But there are other health practitioners as well that specialize in jaws. So sometimes it's about finding those people just through your friends or your networks as well. But the physios definitely do a fantastic job.
Arosha, some people would be listening thinking, okay, so what? Bit of teeth grinding, that seems fairly benign. But can you talk to us about the links to brain health, heart health, you know, the longer term health risks that are associated with not addressing something like this?
Sure. Well, the things that I've seen observed in my patients over the years is and things that I've wished I didn't have to do. I've had patients split their teeth in half.
Ouch.
Because they've been chronic grinding, clenching. And some of those teeth they didn't even have fillings in them. And that, you know, when you do that, you just have to take them out. So that's, you know, a significant issue because you're losing a tooth. But let's say, for example, you have sleep apnea and you're grinding your teeth. Not being able to breathe effectively is causing people stress. It's releasing stress hormones in your body. And I think people with sleep apnea have a higher risk of getting a stroke, developing or getting strokes or heart attacks and other issues. So it's not just related to grinding, though, but I know that we're seeing a large body of evidence we're relating oral health or dental issues to things like Alzheimer's and dementia and heart attacks, for example. And that's related to inflammation, mm-hmm. and mostly related to things like gum disease and dental infections, because you might be managing this abscess, which some people do, mm-hmm. Because it with time, what your body's...
Oh, we're just losing you, Arusha, sorry.
Oh, sorry.
We might have to wrap just because that line appears to be getting a little bit dodgy. But Arusha Veerakone, thank you so much for all of your expertise. You've given us the very clear message that we need to be looking after our oral hygiene. We appreciate you speaking to us on the Conversation Hour.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Let's go to Judy from Mount Eliza. We've been talking earlier in the show about your very first job, what you remember about it and what skills that you still use from that first job. Judy, what was your first job?
We lived in Sea Lake at the time, mm-hmm. in the Mallee, and in my summer job, the first one was working in a shoe shop, which I thoroughly enjoyed. But then the next one, I was offered a job, and I took it, at the dry cleaners behind the counter, mm-hmm. little realising that very hot outside, extremely hot inside. dry cleaning shops, not the coolest environment.
And what did that teach you, Judy, about that particular job? Did you want to stay in that particular job, or did you learn, you know what, this is not for me?
Definitely was not for me. I ended up being involved in banking, so quite a different career altogether.
I hope the banking building had air conditioning, Judy.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I love it. Judy, thank you for calling in and sharing your story with us.
Thanks, Georgie. Bye.
Bye-bye. A couple of texts coming in too. We've got Pam talking about her first job on a dairy farm. She had to do everything from milking cows, gardening, cleaning and cooking. Six kids. And thankfully, we all got an allowance that we could do whatever with. We were encouraged to save, but the dolly magazines, oh, how good were the dolly magazines? The makeup and all the things teenagers like were too tempting. Pamela, I hear you. I was addicted to dolly magazine. Love that. Richard, hay carting was the first work that paid money as a kid, but my first job was a chemist boy delivering medicine to the neighbourhood on a bike, carrying all the stock up the stairs and dealing with all the rubbish. I can still break a box down very quickly. Richard, I love that. Gee, I don't think, Richard, they'd let young kids carry drugs around on bikes anymore. It's a little bit more regulated, isn't it? Oh, I'm loving all of these messages about your very first job. Very soon we're going to be talking about feel-bad movies, not feel-good movies. I like a cheeky feel-bad movie, so I want to hear from you about whether you like a feel-bad movie. I'll explain it all very soon. But let's get an update from the tennis, the Australian Open. Lauren Borden, you're there again. Lauren, before we get into the matches for today and what's coming up on the courts, Serena Williams was on the Today Show in the US and possibly talking about a tennis comeback. Let's listen to what she said when she was asked if she would come back to tennis.
Recently, you re-entered the drug testing pool, which some people see as like the precursor to a return to tennis. So, you know, I have to ask, are you returning to professional tennis?
I mean, really? Oh, my goodness.
Is that a no?
Is that a no?
Okay, but you didn't say yes or no.
I'm just having fun and enjoying my life right now.
Okay, but that's not a yes or a no.
That's not a yes or a no. I don't know. I'm just going to see what happens.
Oh, Lauren Borden. I know she is an incredible media performer. She knows exactly what she's doing with the media. But, Lauren, that wasn't a denial.
No, it wasn't. She kind of just paused and tried to speak around it and didn't really say much. But I guess it comes to the fore when her sister Venus has just played at the Australian Open, who's a year older than Serena. And she did all right in the first round here without being able to win. So I think there'd be plenty of people who'd want to see Serena Williams come back, a lot of tournament organisers that would, because imagine the draw cards. She's a huge draw card if you could get her back at the US Open or bring her out to the Australian Open. But she's also a tennis player that I don't think would come back unless she knew she was in tip-top shape, because I would put her in the same category as a Novak Djokovic, who basically goes, if I can't compete and win the thing, I'm not really interested in it. So, but I wouldn't put it past her. But if she went back into training, I think she'd still be a very powerful player at 45.
Amazing. Could you imagine that? I would be there in a heartbeat to see that. Speaking of Djokovic, what's going to happen today?
So, yeah, today, I mean, tonight it's Djokovic and Sinner. That's the match that's the headlining match on Rod Laver Arena this evening. I can only see it going one way in terms of Jannik Sinner getting this win. He's won the last five encounters that the two have played, and they've got a head-to-head that's almost even, but obviously Sinner coming in recently as the star player. You know, Djokovic almost shouldn't be here if Lorenzo Musetti didn't injure his kind of thigh area in the quarterfinal. He wouldn't even be in this semi-final. So you're based off that form, and I can't see him being able to get over Sinner, given how clinical Jannik Sinner has been throughout this tournament, and again against Ben Shelton the other night. It was almost a boring match just watching him go about it. So I think there's, you know, something in it, in this being the old head going up against the new head, and what can Djokovic show against Sinner to, you know, maybe put a little bit of pressure on him, show some experience. But I can't see Novak getting over the line and getting into another Australian Open final tonight.
He has had a lot of time to hug that tree, though, Lauren.
Oh, the tree!
So, you know, maybe that's going to put him in a really great mental state. I just don't put anything past him. So,
well, and that's the other angle, isn't it? You'd never want to count out Novak Djokovic because he's very, very smart from a mental side of things. You know, he will come into this match with a good plan and maybe a few mental ways that he might be able to rattle Jannik Sinner at some point. So you're right, he might have been in the botanical gardens out hugging that tree for some good juju.
Now, you were on record. You said Sabalenka was going to win when we spoke yesterday. You were right. Well done.
Yeah, well, that was, I mean, in the end, that ended up being quite simple for Arina Sabalenka. Got over the line in two sets, 6-2, 6-3. So, yeah, she did it fairly easily, didn't she, Arina? Mm. She didn't get tested too much by Svitolina in the end. Just some of the forehands that Sabalenka was sending over the net beautifully just whipped them over, and that was the end of the point. She finished off points very easily on return, particularly on Svitolina's second serve. She just put her away. So, again, Sabalenka comes into this this final, and so does her opponent, Rybakina, after she won later on. Neither of those two have lost a set throughout the tournament, so they're both in fine form. And yeah, I don't think Sabalenka worked up too much of a sweat last night.
No, and when she gets fired up like she did with the call about the grunting, that just works in her. She becomes this tigress. She's incredible.
She does. And yeah, that's the exact thing with Sabalenka, is she's good in the big moments because they spur her on. I think she really takes them on board, and she wants them. She wants to be in these moments where her back might be against the wall, or, you know, someone comes at her and, you know, calls a hindrance call, and she wants to prove them wrong. So yeah, excellent last night. And I think having lost here last year, that would be another thing that would really spur her on to be able to defeat Alena Rybakina again in the final on Saturday night.
Well, enjoy, lap it up. We're at the pointy end. It always gets a bit sad this time of the Open because you're like, oh, it's nearly over, which means the year has to start and we have to get back to work. But you enjoy the weekend. And, Lauren, thanks for being so great with all of the information.
Thanks, Georgie. Appreciate it.
Do sad films make you feel better? I'm intrigued to see what you feel about going off to a feel-bad movie. We'll talk about that next.
This is The Conversation Hour with Georgie Coghlan.
You're listening to The Conversation Now. Great to have your company. We've been talking about your very first job, what you remember, whether you still use those skills in your life today. Joe is calling from Q. What was your first job, Joe?
It was working in my father's pharmacy in Croy. Now, this is back in the 50s, and he made a lot of his own medicines. And you walk into the shop and smell the eucalyptus and honey that he had for the cough medicine. I had to wash all the bottles in hot soapy water and drain them. And I loved the beautiful white jars with the gold labels, the apothecary jars. It was just shelled. But what I loved most was the Max Factor traveller coming in and with the new range of perfume and makeup. I was very interested in that too.
Of course, Joe, because how old were you when you were working in your dad's pharmacy?
Oh, probably about 12, 13, when I started doing those little jobs,
Heaven. And if you happened to get a little sample or something, imagine showing your girlfriends that, they would have been so jealous.
Yes, it was one way of spending the money I earned, that's for sure.
And in beautiful Koroit, Joe. I love Koroit. What a fantastic town. I've got very, very dear friend Karen who lives in Koroit. It's such a beautiful part of Victoria.
Oh, well, I go back. I try and go back every year so I can meet up with three special friends I still have there. So I'll get on the train and go to Warrnambool. Yeah, but it is. I love Tower Hill.
Yeah, Tower Hill's stunning, isn't it? And the Irish festival that they have in Koroit, that's a fantastic hoot. What are you up to this morning, Jo?
I'm off to my Silver Swans ballet lesson.
Hang on. We need to unpack this. Silver Swans ballet lesson?
It's for older people who love ballet. And it's really mostly bar work, and it keeps me it keeps my spine straight. So I can highly recommend it.
Joe, I adore this. So you're off, and how many people in the class?
Well, there's only five of us at the moment, but we've got the most lovely teacher, Miss Lucy, and she does beautiful music for us, and we have a lovely hour of exercise, a little bit of centre work, and it's wonderful. Yeah, you always feel good after it.
Oh, Joe, that has inspired many of us listening to you this morning. You go and enjoy that beautiful music and connecting with your friends and your body. I just love that. Thank you so much for calling in this morning.
Might see you in Koroit.
We'll see you in Koroit. Bye, Joe. Oh, I adore that. So Joe's off to do her thing on a Friday. The weekend's almost here. We've got Oscar season in full swing. Don't you find this time of the year there's so many great films? I keep sort of screenshotting everything, thinking, I need to go and see that, must go and see that. So if you're thinking of heading to the movies, are you thinking about a feel-good film, you know, a chance to shake off what's been a bit of a heavy week? Or how do you feel about a feel-bad movie? So can a film that leans into sadness, grief or discomfort actually leave us feeling better than something light and uplifting? And I'm asking because I'm thinking about seeing Hamnet, you know, huge hype around this film. It's an Oscar favourite, but it deals with grief in a huge way. Personally, I am drawn to that sort of cathartic experience. I don't mind sort of going into a movie and having a massive cry, an ugly cry. But the other side of the coin is, do films like this, you know, edge into emotional manipulation? Because if you are someone that is grieving and going through something, is watching a film like this helpful, or could it actually do more harm than good? I'm really intrigued about this topic. And Sarah O'Doherty is a registered psychologist. She's also president of the Australian Association of Psychologists. Good morning, Sarah. Will you go and see the film Hamnet?
I'm a big Shakespeare nerd, so I definitely will be seeing this one.
Okay, so you have no concerns about how deep and dark it can be with the grief?
Well, I guess personally and also professionally, grief is something that I deal with quite often with a lot of my clients. And I don't fear the grief. I do want to be able to explore how this movie actually, you know, will deal with such a big topic. And, you know, there's a lot of different ways of kind of dealing with it. So I'll be really keen to see how this movie does it.
So, Sarah, personally, I'm someone who walks out of a sad film feeling really light and cleansed almost. Is there a psychological value in that cathartic experience?
Absolutely. It's like wanting to put on sad playlists and really just feel our emotions. What we're doing is we are giving ourselves permission to sit with and feel and really explore some of those emotions that maybe we've been bottling up or masking in other aspects of our lives. So it definitely can have that cathartic effect.
Do you think a film like this could be triggering, though, depending on someone's trauma, someone's life experience? Do we have to be careful about who we sort of suggest, hey, why don't you come to this, not knowing what that person might be going through?
Definitely. And, you know, this film does deal with some heavy themes. And I think that if we feel as though it's not going to be healthy or helpful for us to go and see that movie, maybe wait till it, you know, comes onto one of the streaming services and we can decide if we want to partake in it in that way in a bit more of a comfy setting. But I guess it's also on that other person to decide if it's for them. So we can absolutely ask our friends to go and see it with us, but then the other person can say, you know what, maybe this isn't for me. Mm-hmm. Let's go see something a bit more lighter or action-packed.
What about seeing it in the cinema as opposed to watching it at home? Do we still mask in a cinema because we're in a public space? Are we better off? I mean, I don't mind being upset in public. It doesn't sort of worry me because I'm quite emotionally open and available, but I can understand that that would be quite confronting and a bit too vulnerable for some people.
It absolutely can be. And I think that it really depends on the individual. So I absolutely don't mind a big screen cry. but I do think that it can be challenging for people where maybe their grief is very personal and private and they haven't really expressed any of their emotion outwardly. So that might not be something that they are comfortable or familiar with sharing in a public space. But for others, it can be something that, you know, is quite relieving and cathartic. So it really just depends on, I guess, how we want that experience to look and feel when we're there.
My teenage daughter and I, if we're feeling a little bit tetchy, pent up, maybe processing energy and emotions that we need to get out of our body, we always watch the film Marley and Me. Have you seen that film?
I haven't, actually. Is it about the dog?
It's about the dog. We're not going to give, I mean, yes, it's pretty obvious what happens with the dog, spoiler alert for people, but we sort of look at each other and say, oh, do we need to do a Marley and Me today? It's almost like we deliberately rewatch a film that's going to trigger us. Why do we do that, particularly when we know what we're going to get?
It can be a very comforting, almost like a cozy blanket to come back to. You know, we feel safe, we feel warm, we feel held when we're engaging with something familiar, even when the emotions can be quite big. So it's a time-limited experience. It only goes for, you know, an hour and a half, 2 hours. Mm-hmm. We know that we're going to feel better afterwards. We've done it before. And that way it's sort of, you know, I know what to expect. I feel safe doing it. I know what the outcome is going to be. And so I don't really mind engaging in it that way.
I like that safe sadness. That makes sense to me.
Absolutely. And that safe sadness, you know, it's almost like scheduling our emotions. If we're feeling like we have to mask or suppress our sadness or our grief during the day, mm-hmm. we can schedule our emotions. You know, from 6:15 to 6:30, I'm going to feel sad. I'm going to play Lana Del Rey and have a bit of a cry. and that might be cathartic for us as well. So it really can kind of bookend that experience for us.
Because let's be honest, I mean, we can't be happy all the time. That's not sustainable. You know, we're humans, we're complicated. Life is a mix of being happy, being sad, being angry, being frustrated. Don't forget, you can call us and talk to us about whether you like feel bad movies, 1-300-222-774 or text us 0437 774 774. Do you like an ugly cry? Do you deliberately put yourself into a feel bad movie so that you can cleanse and get upset? Or is it not your thing? And talk to us about why it's not your thing. Sarah, I wouldn't be choosing Hamnet, though, for a date night. You don't think that would work? I don't know whether I'd be getting a second date if I took off to Hamnet on a date night.
I mean, look, it probably isn't first date material unless you really want to be open and sharing some of those really personal experiences. but look, I mean, I guess it really is up to the individual. So if you're both Shakespeare nerds, then absolutely go for it.
That's right. I mean, you love Shakespeare and you want an emotionally available and vulnerable partner. Maybe that's a great test to take them.
I agree.
To Hamnet.
I agree. And then you can both, you know, talk about what it brought up for you afterwards.
Yes.
And it's a great way of forging a deeper bond.
Well, you know, you might as well try before you buy, hey, and know exactly what
Absolutely.
You're getting. I love it, Sarah. Well, I'm going to be brave, I think, and head off probably on my own. I don't know. I don't think my husband would enjoy it. So I might head off on my own to see Hamnet and make sure I'm, you know, in my safe sadness. I find this topic really intriguing. Sarah O'Doherty, thank you so much for joining us on The Conversation Hour.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, coming up next, I want to talk to you about what we can learn from the flowers.
Little bread and butterflies kiss the tulips, and the sun is like a toy balloon. There are get up in the morning glories in the golden afternoon. There are dizzy daffodils on the hillside. Strings of violets are all in tune. Tiger lilies of the
That's one of my favourites, All in the Golden Afternoon, from Alice in Wonderland. And the reason why is because, as Melburnians, we know how lucky we are to have the Melbourne Royal Botanic Gardens right next door to me here, by the way, at the ABC studios. And now it seems that the rest of the world agrees. Whether you're losing yourself in the bright pink blooms on the lotus pond, finding a cool retreat in Fern Gully, or taking your little ones to the Ian Potter Garden Centre, they are serene, they're magical, and they're full of hidden surprises. And now our very own Melbourne Royal Botanic Gardens has received international recognition, recently celebrated by the New York Times. Chris Russell is the Director and Chief Executive of the Royal Botanic Gardens. Good morning, Chris. I imagine you're always proud of the gardens, but are you extra proud that the New York Times has put you on the map even more?
We are. We're thrilled to have this international recognition. It's something that I think, yeah, Melburnians love us already and have for over 180 years, but it's really nice for that word to be spreading around the globe to get, mentioned as one of the must-visit places for 2026 coming to the Royal Botanic Gardens, Melbourne. And it's on the back of an earlier mention in May last year where the Royal Botanic Gardens, Cranbourne, we've got the two sites, Melbourne and Cranbourne, got a mention as, came in at number six, actually, just ahead of Sydney
we love that too.
Gardens, yeah, sorry.
Don't we, Chris? We do love that. There.
No, just quietly. But both lovely gardens, but gardens you must see in your lifetime in the top 25. So, yeah, we're really, really proud of that.
Oh, and as you and as all the Melburnians and Victorians and Australians should be, you've also been getting lots of attention due to Novak Djokovic revealing that he's been hugging a tree there for years. Has that drawn more people in? They all trying to find his tree?
It's a great mystery and intrigue, isn't it? Novak has been visiting the gardens for about 20 years now, and it was lovely hearing him talk the other night after one of his matches about the importance of coming to natural places. And for him, you know, he very much loves the gardens, but he has a special fig that he visits and shares his deepest thoughts and frustrations with. But just that broader, topic, which many of us know about connecting with nature and just the value of, you know, emotionally and spiritually and health effects, which are well researched now in terms of spending time in nature. And, you know, it's a great example, but also great intrigue. People wondering, well, which fig is it? We have about 40 figs on site. So, you know, we have people going around, you know, with the backdrop of the image that was posted and, you know, is it this one?
Is it this one?
Yeah. So that's a lovely touch too.
Look, we are so, so lucky, Chris, aren't we, to have these stunning gardens right in the middle of our city. I adore them. And when I was working in Melbourne a lot and we had our daughter was quite young, you know, we'd take her to the Ian Potter Garden all of the time with the beautiful waterfalls and the bamboo forests. And it is quite exquisite, and it's free. People keep forgetting, you know, you've got this incredible resource there. Do you personally have a secret spot in the gardens that makes you feel grounded and peaceful, like a little bit like royalty yourself?
I have a few for sure, and what a place to work. I mean, even in the wonderful job, the privilege that I've got, you know, there are times you can get a bit stressed and need to decompress and go for a walk. And I'm lucky I can just walk out the door. But Fern Gully, I love this time of year, just the lush coolness. You walk in there and if it's a hot day, it's, you know, 4 or 5 degrees cooler. You know, so it's a great sanctuary for humans and other animals. It's so I love that this time of the year, the lotus are flowering down by Ornamental Lake. So
gorgeous.
They're a great draw card. Punting on the lake is another great thing to do. So we have a wonderful team who have beautiful traditional timber crafted punts, flat bottom punts. So you can, you know, grab a parasol and have a beautiful, relaxing and different experience seeing the garden from Ornamental Lake. You know, visiting the islands and the little bays, seeing the birds and wildlife. It's just such great different ways to experience the gardens.
I'm a big gardener myself, Chris. Mm-hmm. I absolutely love it. We live on a property just outside of Ballarat in Victoria.
Yeah.
And I'm what you were saying to before, I really relate to, because I can go a certain amount of time during the week if I'm getting a bit anxious and I just have to step out into the garden, ideally in bare feet, even though we don't have any snakes, being careful of snakes this time of the year. And it is so grounding, isn't it? I love that there's more and more research showing us that just as we connect to Mother Nature, the benefits that we have. I understand the perennial border is having a bit of a moment. Is it at the moment?
Yeah, it is. Lots of floral colour there as well. So many areas, and people have favourite spots for sure. So I think one thing that makes Melbourne Gardens so beautiful is the undulation and the vistas and the views. I mean, we're 180 years old. It's had a long time to mature, but we've been really careful as we've continued to evolve the landscape, which is important. Gardens evolve, but also maintaining that heritage and the beauty of the long vistas that are such an important part of the picturesque garden design that we have here, retaining them so that we don't, it would be very easy to just kind of keep planting and lose those sweeping views and across to the city. And I think it's those sorts of special elements that make it, such a great place to visit. So you can come and have a, as you say, bring family and a picnic blanket and sit on the lawn, but a whole range of other activities that you can do as well. So
yes, free. Like it is such a beautiful resource. As you say, the view, that vista is just majestic looking across the city. It's so protected. It can be quite windy and you go into that centre of the garden, particularly when you go down near the beautiful pond there. It's just a little oasis if you have any chance to come into the city or need to come into the city for work. I even know people, Chris, who are dealing with really serious medical issues or family that are in hospitals that grab a tram up to the gardens to sort of reset and basically sort of try and take away some of that anxiety by coming into the garden. So I'm so excited that the New York Times have put you on the world stage. It's well deserved. And thanks so much, Chris, for chatting to us today on the Conversation Hour.
Great to chat and look forward to seeing everyone in their gardens. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Chris. We have been talking about feel bad movies. We've got some wonderful texts coming in. Marilyn says, "Hi, Georgie. I'm going to the afternoon session of Habnat today. My sister highly recommended it and she doesn't cry." Ooh, heading off to Delacombe. Oh, well, good luck, Marilyn. Gee, that's brave of your sister if she normally doesn't cry. Danny, "Perhaps it's because I'm now in my 50s, old enough to experience grief. I can't think of anything worse. Life is hard enough in reality. Give me laughter any time. Maybe when I'd been younger, but I still doubt it." I love it, Danny. You've got to do you. And text here, read the book Habnat first. You must. It's fabulous. I've had the most wonderful time here in the last 3 days. And I'll see you soon. But you have a wonderful weekend. Go and do a bad movie. See you guys. Thanks for having me.